Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monocle Radio's food and drink program. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. Coming up, we sit down with Japanese chef Endo Katsutoshi to find out why good sushi is all about mentality.
Three high school offer me the teach. That for me is a great opportunity. Then 1 week I'm thinking, I was 22 years old, I'm thinking, maybe better I choose my dream.
Also on the program, we're back in Milan, just in time for aperitivo.
Vittorio Emanuele was born in 1867, the first Campari bar from Gaspare, the founder, and the real genius alchemist and the creator of the secret recipe we are using until today.
Plus, we meet a Viennese baker with a nose for entrepreneurship. All that here on The Menu on Monocle Radio. All chefs need to train painstakingly for years to hone their craft. But when it comes to becoming a sushi master, that attention to detail and perfectionism is taken to a whole another level. Many aspiring sushi chefs have to dedicate themselves to the same single task for years before they can even dream of serving a nigiri to a guest. Endo Katsutoshi may have originally desired a different career than taking over his family restaurant in Yokohama, but eventually he realized the satisfaction that comes with truly investing all of your energy in an endeavor with razor-sharp precision. Having worked in kitchens in Tokyo and Spain, he now carries that spirit into his restaurants in London, Endo at La Rotunda and the brand new Kyoku. Other than accurate technique and a devotion to using local ingredients, what makes these places special is what he calls the mentality behind Tokyo-style sushi. Endo joined me in the studio to discuss how times of struggle can ignite a genuine passion and talk about what makes the cut in his omakase.
First of all, I would like to start from the beginning. What attracted you to becoming a sushi master? Obviously, there is family lineage, but in that, what of the craft and the art attracted you to it?
I never thinking about this sushi chef. This is not my work. It's kind of my destiny. So you already mentioned too about my background. Is I born in a sushi restaurant. So actually my grandpa opened a sushi bar in 1940. I'm first son. Maybe England as well. It's first son. It's allowed to kind of take responsibility over the family. So my big sisters and I, is the gap is 8 years old. So my family, everybody looking for the first son. Then I'm born. So I was 5 years old. Already my mom educated me about the chef. Of course, I'm not using knife, but kind of mentality. And so we call it to shinzui, like essence of the chef. For example, I learned tea ceremony and flower arrangement, also calligraphy. The basically in Japan is young kids after school, everybody go to the baseball and play to with friend. I don't have nothing experience this. Always after school, straight go to the kind of that's like every day, Monday to Saturday. The Sunday always I'm supporting the restaurant. That's my kind of like my key of the how to grow to my mentality of the chef, I think.
The idea of mentality of the chef is so interesting when then you look at the way that your training evolved as well, right? Because anyone who's kind of a bit clued up on how sushi chefs train will know that it takes a while before you can actually get in front of customers. A lot of the work that leads you there is actually behind the scenes is doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And that happened to you as well, didn't it? And how did it feel, both practically but also mentally?
That's maybe key as well. I went to high school and university. That university is worst things. I get the teacher's license of the physical education. I have a master of the sports science, sports technology. Then three high school offer me the teach. That for me is a great opportunity. Then 1 week I'm thinking, I was 22 years old, I'm thinking, maybe better I choose my dream. Then family meeting, my parents, my big sister, my young brother and I, we chat. Okay, I'm sorry about it. Unfortunately, I take over the family business because chef mentality is quite unique. It's unusual. For me, like in the beginning, it's very struggling.
At what point did that struggle turn into a passion? At what point did you actually fall in love with doing it? Maybe it wasn't cleaning fish for 3 years at that restaurant, but how did that feel? And at what point did you shift?
Actually, seriously, 1 year is no passion because, you know, I have many people. I'm an educator as well and an ex-restaurant now as well. I saw the young chef cutting anything. We catch already. He's feeling no great. Also, no passion today, no sick, like something like that. That's why always I'm shaken in the morning. Hi, how are you, everybody? Then I catch a feeling. Maybe my master already, I met him, and he understanding. Then 1 year later, we go to drink together. He asking me always, like, what's my feeling? What's my future plan? What's my dream? I speak to him straight, nothing. I'm take over my family business. Family business is going well. It's consistency. That's my dream. He told me 3 years. Okay, Endo, 3 years is okay. 3 years work with me. Then you try your best. Then after 3 years, nothing happening, he decide me. Maybe I have to keep going to chef or I choose my dream. 3 years, you have to concentrate after let's talk. So that 3 years only, it's okay. 3 years is okay. So please work with him. I tried my best. So my senior chef also supporting a lot. So about how chef is good, how, you know, chef life is great. That's most my memory as well. One of the guests order like a bento box. It's a maki roll, 3 maki roll. So he's a takeaway. He order takeaway. He order me. So can you make for me sort of 1 bento box? Then the guest next day coming back to me. He say, incredible, that's amazing, all family is happy. Then I'm little bit changing. I made some people happy. That little by little, the experience is coming to me. So for me, it's little by little understanding, that's not for me. Why I create for the guests, for my environment. That's kind of like appreciation. Then I'm back to the beginning. I was kids. Always my mom told me, I have to appreciate for everybody. The chef's life is like that. So maybe that's almost big change in my point in the beginning, I think, in the chef life.
What's your relationship with tradition? Because we talked so much about this felt like a destiny to you and you had a very strict, in some respects, training in it, very traditional in many respects. What's your relationship with tradition now? Do you think that there is room to change in such a hallowed world of cuisine like that of sushi tradition?
Tradition meaning like how I grow, also how I learn, then I improve. That's my key in the beginning. After that, I have to innovate. I work with many chefs. I catch inspire. Then I innovation. But key is like how they teaching me, I'm improve. That's maybe very important. Then after that innovation, that's maybe the way of the tradition. But for me, the skill wise also, I follow up to my master's way. Then a little bit my essence together. That's kind of an innovation. It's very sensitive about tradition or not tradition. Even Tokyo style. Tokyo style is in the beginning is 100 years ago, the sushi chef in Tokyo, they're using fish from Tokyo. But now impossible. Though everybody, we discuss about what's a Tokyo style, what Tokyo style sushi. Maybe kind of mentality, the spirit of that way. That's maybe key. That's why individually sushi chef is different tradition, I think.
It's really interesting that you talk about that essence because when we think about omakase in general, it's up to you. It's up to the chef.
Yeah.
How much of you is in the dishes that you make? How important is it, your personality, your taste, your mood on the day? What goes into it?
The first is the mood, of course, up and down. But always I believe skill. Skill is never going up and down. Each section has a reason. After me, of course, but 10 people in front of me, 10 people all different. Size, way, right-hand side is this way, left-hand side people this way. I'm totally different. Of course, I decide the dish, but I never order. The fisherman only just automatically send me. I'm thinking what I do today. But after that, always how guest is more memorable. That's why small detail for me is very important. Some people very silent. Some people very energy. That's why I'm always adjusting. We call it omotenashi. This Japanese word is like hospitality. That's maybe very important as well.
Everything is so personal to you. You know, it's your journey, it's your memories, it's your choices, it's you in the restaurant. But you're also turning into kind of a chef patron. You know, you're turning into a restaurateur. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with having to delegate to other people? And how do you deal with building this team and it not physically not being possible for everything to be you all the time?
I'm sure to them what I want. Sometimes I'm very emotional. Last time my guests see my briefing, we extremely like a passion. Also sometimes crying. Always I speak to everybody. You know, my door is always open, fully open 24/7. But no action, nothing happening. That's why always specialty in church, I really always, you know, we are Japanese. We love drink. That's why any day we go together, it's a drink as well. We chat a lot. What are our dream? What do you dream? What do we do next week? That's, for me, communication also is my job in my chef patron, it's all the group. That's why I have to go. I have to communicate. I grip knife. I cooking together. I'm sure. I show to everybody my skill. You know, when chef are watching me, they catching. Ah, Endo-san want this. Ah, Endo-san see this. The plating, cooking, it's like more combined. Also, I learn from somebody. You know, young chef also, a lot of idea. I mean, oh, you're great. So we do get together. I don't want to draw the line because finally our goal is for the guests.
That was Endo Katsutoshi speaking to me at Midori House. You're listening to The Menu. Next, we head to Milan, where Salone del Mobile is in full swing. No day around the furniture fair is complete without an end-of-day aperitivo in between exhibitions, presentations and a good old party. Some people will grab a spritz on a terrace in Brera, some will find a perch by the canal on the Navigli, most will crowd on a pavement around the celebrated Barbasso. But there's arguably few places around town better for enjoying a ruby-red aperitif than the spot where bitter Campari was first prepared. Established in 1915, the Camparino in Galleria, located right by the Duomo, is one of Milan's best-preserved and most historic bars. Opened by Davide Campari, son of Campari founder Gaspare, the bar changed hands over the decades but returned to the internationally renowned group in 2019. Our Milan-based Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, popped by to meet Camparino's Tommaso Cecca to talk about the Art Nouveau interiors, the new basement Gaspare Campari room, and receive a schooling in how to make the perfect Campari cocktail.
The story of Campari and Camparino are very well connected since the beginning. So we are in 1860 when Gaspare Campari moved to Milan with his first bar. And then the Galleria Vittorio Emanuele was born in 1867, the first Campari bar from Gaspare, the founder and the real genius alchemist and the creator of the secret recipe we are using until today. Camparino in Gallerias comes in the 1915 when the third son of Gaspare Campari, Davide, was born, and Davide was the entrepreneur. That's why Davide Campari tried to collect the best artists and designers of that time to build the first bar under the name of Camparino in Galleria, in the full Liberty style, and three artists called to create a magnificent bar: Angiolo d'Andrea, Eugenio Quarti, and the steelmaker who created the chandelier, the two big chandeliers. The Liberty style is reflected totally in the mosaic, you know, full of birds, energy in the Liberty style. The counter is still today like the first. That means the knowledge we have in Italy, the handcrafted style, and let me say, talking about aperitivo, that corner was the most wanted place to find new connection. The Bar di Passo, how Davide called this beautiful space is very easy to access, you know. You can enjoy the moment of the ritual in making cocktail, how we can serve the perfect balance in between Campari and other ingredients, the Campari cells. So basically the first recipe of Campari, very cold, in the proper glass designed by Davide Campari, and splash it with soda. You know, this create the magic foam, and today is represented not only in the cocktail and, you know, overall also in the brand we create.
I mean, you were talking about the history. There was a time when this wasn't owned by Campari and it came back into the group in 2019. Was there just a recognition of how important this place was? You know, this is the very core, it seems, of what Campari is all about.
For sure, you know, the Campari of today is an incredible preservation, a story of heritage, culture, and basically that intersection. This is one of the last piece of Liberty style intact in the Galleria, because, you know, all the other places are renewed many times in the last century. And we are proud of this in terms of recognition worldwide and not only local. The cocktail that we are making every day, it represents a very good job of preservation, of translation into the future of an historic brand.
I mean, you were talking about the amazing mosaic of the main bar, the incredible wood, the lighting, you know, this Art Nouveau style that is obviously historic, but at the same time somehow has a modern quality as well in some ways. How much does that translate what Campari is all about? And does it really mean, given the history, given family members were born and lived here, I think they even had a cafe opposite at one point, does that mean Campari, despite being, of course, an international brand, is forever linked to the city of Milan?
Definitely the link with the city in the culture, it's deep in the heart, and the advertising in the last 160 years, you know, represents part of the Milanese culture and what Davide Campari wants for his brand. For example, in Camparino, we have many form of art. Making cocktail today is a form of art.
Let's talk about where we are now. We've come down the stairs to the newest addition to Camparino. It's a beautiful arched basement room. Tell us a little bit about this latest addition. The bar keeps getting bigger.
Yes, we are making new places in an old space.
You probably run out of room now, actually.
Yeah, we are trying to reinterpret the historic place like this, the Sala Gaspare Campari.
There's a bust of the man himself in the corner we're looking at.
It is the bust of Gaspare Campari, which represents the soul of the room, the genius behind the creativity of Bitter Campari. Basically, the ground floor represents the Italian bar, the classic Italian bar, open arms to the city. The Sala Spiritello represents a step up in terms of creativity, in terms of approach overall, also in the ambient, which is very modern. And the Sala Gaspare Campari want to be a place where we are very focused on the Gaspare history and all his creation around liqueurs. That's why we have a special menu here.
You probably mixed a few Campari cocktails over your life. Why do you think people come back for more Campari every time?
More than some and thousands, for sure. A complicated question, but I think there are many facts. There are many ingredients, for sure. The secret recipe behind the liquid, the color, the complexity of who knows how many botanicals are behind.
Given your privileged role here at Camparino, tell us, educate us about what is perfect aperitivo etiquette.
Be you and be curious. And walking in Camparino, let me say, it's very easy to be transported in another world of Italian culture, connected with the modern times, you know, hospitality, open arms, smile. For the rest, starting with simple things is another point. The Campari cells, the Campari spirits, a very well-made Milano Torino. We are talking about cocktail with a complexity from the product, but very understandable. You know, umami, warm in your mouth.
Well, you're making me thirsty. I think we should maybe try some of these drinks.
Let me introduce you, I think, the Campari and Seltz. One part of fruits and Campari in the Campari Seltz glass, and then soda, Seltz, water, splashed in this sense. You know, the foam, it makes the cocktail very unique. The foam you feel, the flavors, the bubbles are coming up. You can smell the Campari flavor in this.
I'm going to smell it.
Yeah.
I was being told before we started recording that one of the secrets, I believe, in this, the foam you get on top, is the water.
Technically talking, we are making homemade sparkling water, but the real secret is in the moment when we spread the water by this special soda gun. And the little hole on the neck here.
Yeah, there's four little holes at the end of the gun.
Create the pressure of 5 bar and the water splash into the frozen Campari to create this whipping with the foam.
I have to say also that this gun that sprays the soda is a thing of beauty. It's so nice to look at. I mean, we are in the home of design, but it looks like it's been very well thought out.
The design is the same of 1920-30 and is a piece of Italian handmade steel soda gun.
Should I try this here? What do you think?
There is no aperitivo without a toast. That's why. Cin cin. Salute.
Salute.
Ed Stocker there with that report. This is The Menu. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's George Ruskin.
Declining sake production has led to an increasing number of breweries in Japan to switch to whiskey production. Consumption of sake has dropped 30% since 2011, whilst demand for Japanese whiskey has risen sharply. There are now 114 whiskey producers in the country, playing a pioneering role in stimulating the rural economy and boosting tourism through distillery tours and tastings. In the US, the celebrity chef Dave Chang has been forced to drop his trademark claim over the term chili crunch. Chang was hit with backlash after his legal team served members of the Asian American community cease and desist orders for selling the popular spicy condiment, some of which were based on old family recipes. Chang, who was branded a trademark bully, has apologised and promised to drop any future claims. And finally, a new book by the food historian Alberto Grandi is causing a stir in Italy by arguing that Italian food doesn't actually exist. He argues that pizza has its roots in Spanish cuisine, and regional dishes like pasta only gained national popularity after many Italians migrated to the US. This comes as Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has committed to protecting Italian gastronomy from future influences as part of her nationalist agenda. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Chiara.
Thanks, George. You're listening to The Menu. It's typical for family businesses to pick a specialist trade and stick to it. Whether it be a pasticcio in Modena or a chocolatier in Ghent, places like these have usually perfected and passed down their skills over multiple generations, which is what makes them especially respected and beloved by their clientele. In Austria, there's a particular reverence for heritage businesses like these, which have been cultivating their craft for centuries. That's why it's sometimes hard for those who inherit the activity to break away from these time-honoured traditions. Georg Ölschlagel, however, did just that. Despite being a scion of a perfumer family and still running the imperial-era shop, he also owns Felsel, one of Vienna's best-known bakery chains, as well as an organic farm. So, how does he square fragrances with food? Monocle's Alexei Korolov met Georg for breakfast to find out.
This is our Swedish knot, or Schwedischer Knoten, how we say. It's one of our star products. It came from, as the name says, from Sweden. It's with cinnamon, with sugar, with cardamom. So it's very tasty, and you barely find it in Vienna.
Gyökur Schlegel is a jack of all trades, well, three, and master of them all. Perfumer, organic farmer, and owner of a bakery chain, Georg has entrepreneurship in his blood. His father Erich made his name and his money as a perfume importer.
My father started the whole business years ago. So he worked with really big brands in the 80s, especially with Clarins, Yves Saint Laurent, Giorgio Armani, Paco Rabanne. And it was the time before Austria was part of the European Union. So Austria had to have a distributor for all these brands with their own stock in Austria because there were no open borders for the goods.
But as Europe opened up in the 1990s, a business model based solely on distribution became less viable. And so the family moved into retail. In 1994, it acquired Nägele & Strobel, a storied perfume shop in the heart of Vienna. Other shops followed, and in due course, Georg was made co-CEO, but he wasn't content to stop there. An outdoorsy type, in 2019, his love of nature morphed into a side career.
This idea grew in my head to looking for a house on the countryside, because I'm so often there and I enjoyed it. So I started searching for a house. Then I found an old farmhouse. It's from the 17th century, so it was built in 1640. The plan was to sit there on the weekends, enjoying the sun, doing nothing. But I cannot do nothing. So I started thinking, what can I do there? And there was this property with some apple trees. Let's try to make apple juice. And now I'm an organic farmer producing apple juice, producing honey.
Wait a minute, is that apple juice?
This is my apple juice.
Yeah. This is your apple juice?
Yeah, this is my apple juice.
Then in 2020 came Felsen.
Well, Felsel was a bakery in Vienna, founded by Mr. Felsel, so he is also the man that the name is given from. It was always a high-quality bakery in Vienna, and our tax lawyer asked us if we were interested in an investment, and we said yes, we are open to everything. And then
we as a family, you mean?
Yeah, as a family business. We're a family business, so we as a family. And I'm a farmer, so Felsel was very interesting for me because I was interesting to do something with food. And so we joined the Felsel family, let's say. In these times, I had a co-CEO. Her name was Christina Ostermeier. But then, and there was a point, she said, okay, I want really to quit totally. And she sold all the shares to us. And then the story became very sad because she passed away. My team, we could manage to go on with Felsel and make it a nice story and a nice way.
A perfumer's son, Georg has known the world of fragrances all his life. But with both farming and Felsel, he was on unfamiliar ground.
They were looking to me in a very strange way because I was the guy coming from the big city and now trying there to make a farm. Now I'm totally accepted. And on the other hand, at Felsel, well, people were looking also very carefully and say, hey, he's coming from the perfumery world. What is he doing there? He has no glue.
As time went on, however, Georg found that his different occupations are not so different. In the end, he says, perfumes and pastries come down to one thing.
Both has to do with enjoying and enjoying time. It's quite near these two topics. It's about high quality, it's about good educated employees, it's about nice shops. So it's the same for a fragrance that's very sensitive with the smell, or a bread or something sweet, but it's also the smell and then you have the taste in your mouth. When you go to a perfumery and you want to smell different perfumes and you can explore and find new things. The same in the bakery. You can explore. We have such a big assortment of very good things. You can taste, you can try, you can smell, you can have a good coffee. So that fits very well together and it's very similar.
For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
Thanks, Alexei. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 2000 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan and Lily Austin. Thanks for listening, and until next week.